This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With plastic surgery comes a number of cliches. The classmate who goes on an extended vacation to fix a deviated septum. The aging starlet whose facelift has created a perpetually surprised expression. The B-list celebrity with the swollen lips. Or the extreme cases when plastic surgery goes too far, making a person unrecognizable. Think Michael Jackson. As shocking as the results of these alterations can be, a statistic from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons is even more startling. It estimates that between 2005 and 2013, the number of cosmetic procedures performed on Asian Americans increased by 125%, Hispanics by 85%, and African Americans by 56%, while for Caucasians, the number increased just 35%. Maureen O'Connor wrote about the jump in an article for New York Magazine. Is Race Plastic? My Trip into the Ethnic Plastic Surgery Minefield. She joined us previously on Word of Mouth when the article first came out. So I'd like to start with those numbers that you cite in the article. What accounts for the dramatic and rapid rise in cosmetic procedures among the Asian Americans, African Americans, and Hispanics, especially in recent years?
Well, to some degree, it's probably sort of a catch-up process in that as minorities have, you know, bigger purchasing power, they have more ability to have luxury goods, and plastic surgery is essentially a luxury good in America. On top of that, there is sort of this huge boom in surgery, particularly overseas in Asia, and to some degree, some of the surgeries now occurring stateside are sort of mimicking or following that pattern, too.
What are some of the most commonly performed procedures or requested?
One of the big growth areas has been Asian blepharoplasty, which is the Asian double eyelid surgery, which is when some portion of Asians, not all, have what's called a monolid, which is when the skin on the eye goes straight basically in one plane from the brow to the lash line with no crease. So adding a crease or enlarging a very small crease is a procedure that is pretty much specific and unique to Asians because they are, for the most part, the people that have that type of eye. It's like getting an eye lift, but a little bit different and a little specific to the anatomy of the Asian eye to create that crease.
What are some of the other common procedures?
So under this term, ethnic plastic surgery, which has turned into sort of a surgical term of art now, that also includes things like what is known as an ethnic rhinoplasty, which whereas a traditional rhinoplasty on a Caucasian person will usually be a reduction, pulling down sort of a prominent nose or a hump in a nose by shaving it down or removing some. An ethnic rhinoplasty usually involves the insertion of an implant, which, and you'll see that on, for instance, like Asian people, sometimes African Americans or Latinos at a very low line, the bridge of their nose. And so a surgeon will raise the bridge and perhaps refine the tip, too.
So the sort of sculpted, more Michael Jackson-y look in the later years.
Well, I think that people are trying not to get the Michael Jackson look in particular anymore. But that is, I mean, that's sort of the rough, that's sort of what people associate with it, particularly people that haven't had or don't have familiarity with these surgeries. There's a very sort of negative stigma, in part because of people like Michael Jackson that have had very sort of notorious mess-ups and notorious sort of confusions that end up being racially charged when people look at them, saying, are you trying to erase your ethnicity or change it?
But broadly, these procedures do make people look less ethnic, quote unquote, and that's actually the terminology that some of the plastic surgeons you spoke with. You know, they're kind of whiteifying features. And you spoke to some of the patients about their motivations. And what did you learn?
Well, you know, when I went into it, and particularly because they use that term ethnic plastic surgery, the assumption is that they're trying to remove some level of ethnicity. But 201, absolutely nobody said they wanted to look white. Everybody was sort of talking about modifying their features sort of incrementally, or they want to look like who they actually are, but with something changed. And so it's hard to ignore the fact that, for instance, you're changing this feature that is sort of endemic to Asians, say a monolid, and to say that must have to do with a white ideal. But on the other hand, there are plenty of surgeries that fall under this ethnic plastic surgery umbrella that actually have no Caucasian corollary or no Caucasian ideal connected to it, which, for instance, there's also a trend among the Asian American community of facial contouring, which would be a woman who takes, say, prominent cheekbones and pulls them in and softens them, or gets V-line surgery on her chin to sort of make this sort of small, dainty chin. And those are two things that actually fall under that umbrella and don't have a Caucasian corollary. So as I worked on this, my question sort of started to be, why are we so focused on these things that we can say, oh, that's westernizing? Why are we not willing to take these people at their word when they say it's not about looking white?
Mm. We're talking with Maureen O'Connor, who is a writer for New York Magazine, about the plasticity of race. There's been a huge increase in plastic surgeries among people of Asian American, Hispanic American, and African American descent, people who are changing their features to become, quote unquote, less ethnic or more Western. Or is it that? As we're learning from Maureen, it's a lot more complicated. So calling it ethnic plastic surgery may be an oversimplification or worse, mm-hmm. or a completely racist assumption.
It is, and it's sort of one thing that shocked me as I was working on this was that we're so used to sort of this, in an age of political correctness, to hear somebody say, oh, well, that's a Caucasian feature, that one's very nice, or this is an Asian feature, I would give you plastic surgery on it, is almost blasphemous to the ear of somebody who's so used to extraordinary carefulness when we talk about race. And even that term ethnic plastic surgery sort of defies the common definition of ethnicity, which usually has to do with language and culture, and race, which usually has to includes physical appearance. And so there's sort of this sort of brashness to the way that people go forward with this, which is at one hand very shocking, but on the other hand a little bit freeing as well.
Let's hear an example here from September of last year. The TV personality Julie Chen, she's one of the hosts of this show, The Talk. She revealed that she had undergone blepharoplasty on the show. Now, here she is explaining how it came about, a conversation with her agent.
And I want to show you a side-by-side of how dramatic this surgery really was. I mean, if you look at the after, the eyes are bigger. Mm-hmm. I look more alert.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous.
Mm-hmm. More expressive.
More expressive.
Right. And but how do you feel about yourself right now?
Now it's like I sometimes wonder. But I will say after I had that done, everything kind of, the ball did roll for me. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I struggle with, wow. You know, did I give in to the man and do this? And it was...
Sorry, you didn't give in to the man, Julie. You know, because you don't know about giving in to the man. You know?
Fair enough. Right. I will say this.
Right. You didn't do that. You didn't do that. You didn't do that. You made a choice that was good for you, and you have represented, I'm going to say it, your people. You represented your race. You represented women and your colleagues. Don't look back.
Thank you.
So her co-host says, you know, you didn't give in to the man. But what was the response from the public, especially among Asian Americans?
You know, that just hearing that now, you notice the marked difference between the way the audience is reacting with gasp,
yes.
sort of shock,
uh-huh.
and then the way, you know, Sharon Osbourne saying, fabulous, as though she's discovered some, like, beautiful new shade of eyeshadow. The public... There was a lot more gasping in the public audience than there was among her co-hosts. We'll put it that way, that I think a lot of people saw that, and particularly because she told that story in the context of, I had a boss who said I couldn't be a news anchor because I looked too Chinese. I had an agent who told me he wouldn't take me on. She put it in sort of the world of racism, and I think that is the way a lot of people end up feeling and seeing these procedures. So a lot of people did say, yeah, you gave in to the man. You just said, this is the man, a TV honcho who tells you to get surgery, and you did it. On the other hand, she then did a follow-up where she said, I wasn't trying to erase my race. I don't think that's what this procedure does, which sort of demonstrates the sort of ambivalence that I think a lot of people have.
And a lot of the outrage on these westernizing elements of plastic surgery actually do come from white people. You know, these are the people who say, how could you possibly cave into an agent who would say something like that? So are we putting too much of the onus for this on other ethnic groups?
You know, it is interesting that as I was working on this, all of a sudden I wondered why there's such a vested interest in policing what minorities do to body parts that we associate with their race, and to sort of feel like we need to police that an Asian person, these eyelids we think make them look Asian, and thus they're not allowed to change them. And then I started wondering, where does that impulse come from? Why, you know, why does that all of a sudden become everybody else's business because it's a body part that we associate with racial identity?
You yourself, Maureen, consulted a very famous plastic surgeon, you know, when you were working on this article.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are criticizing doctors who profit off of these procedures. Mm-hmm. Have these surgeries that are popular in other countries been more widely adopted by doctors in the U.S. in recent years?
They're certainly booming, definitely, here. One thing that one doctor pointed out to me was she said, well, when you look at the photos of and the types of surgeries people get, say, in Korea versus the things that Korean Americans or Asian Americans get, it's much more extreme overseas. And to some degree, that's probably because the medical laws and practices are just more loose out there. To another degree, though, what she suggested was she said, well, maybe it's that over here, an Asian person would see all the variety of all different peoples of different races every day. And you get used to sort of thinking that you're altering your face to fit in among a very diverse crowd. And then some of that is the sort of shocking frankness of people who choose to look at beauty and faces as something that can be chosen from among the features of all the peoples in the world. And there's something sort of almost comfortingly, almost post-racial about it in some strange way, to be totally sort of freed from all of the baggage associated with that and to just say, well, these are the features that you want to change. I'm going to change them for you without any bringing in the political implications every single time.
Well, you think, you know, you could say, I want Jessica Alba's nose or Kim Kardashian's bottom, you know. There is this kind of commodification about it that still feels a little creepy, you know, that you can just build yourself or even breed a child to look a particular way.
It's very, it felt very much like science fiction sometimes, although the question is this a dystopia or a utopia? It's sort of alarming in many ways to hear people talking about race and ethnicity with such sort of freeness, as though you can sort of pick and choose pieces of it.
Maureen O'Connor, I want to thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's our earlier conversation with Maureen O'Connor. She writes for New York Magazine. You'll find a link to read her article, Is Race Plastic? My Trip into the Ethnic Plastic Surgery Minefield. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This time of year, they're everywhere, sitting for photos at the mall or ringing jingle bells outside of the grocery store. I'm speaking, of course, about Santas. While they may appear to be an indistinguishable mass of red velvet suits, rosy cheeks, and fake white beards, we wanted to take a closer look. Sean Hurley brings us the story of a surprisingly familiar Saint Nick.
Below a half moon, on a snowbound night, high on a hill in the town of Littleton, an unexpectedly large man with an overturned bucket of tangled hair stepped into the lobby of the Hampton Inn.
He was this, like, big, burly, strong guy.
For the hotel's night manager, Kristen Burkholder, it was hard to tell whether it was a damaged hip or knee that made the man's limp so pronounced. Burkholder noticed the man's two front teeth were missing, that part of his right ear was gone.
He said that he travels with a Santa Claus costume, and if we wanted him to, he'd be happy to hang out in the lobby for an hour and read stories to the kids.
There wasn't any time to make an announcement or put up signs, and Burkholder still isn't sure why. She finally agreed to let the strange man sit in her hotel lobby.
I'm kind of thinking, oh my gosh, Santa's about to show up and this may backfire.
The man disappeared. He dressed in crimson robes and coal black boots. He tucked his wild hair into his Santa wig and drew the white hair down to cover his damaged ear and fixed a plate into his mouth so that Santa would have two front teeth. Red cap in place, he slung a bag full of toys over his shoulder and limped into the lobby.
But he sat down, and all of a sudden, within minutes, there was a line of kids just, you know, patiently waiting to sit on his lap and tell him what they want for Christmas.
Come on over here. Would you like to climb up here?
There you go. Yeah.
Are you looking forward to Christmas?
Yeah, and I saw Johnny.
You saw Johnny?
The owl.
Oh, where did you run into Johnny?
He went in our wreath.
Oh, he went in your wreath, though. That's a good place for an elf, right?
Yeah. He was so great. He was so, like, he was such a nice guy, super interactive, very patient, very friendly.
None of the children and none of their parents knew who the man in the red suit was. That once upon a time, he'd been a kind of nightmare to kids all over the world. But by the time the line had cleared, one of the hotel staff had figured out Santa's real identity.
I had to get your autograph because my daughter's a wrestler.
Santa puts a shushing, secret finger to his lips.
Sorry, she was a wrestler, and she would love...
What's her name?
Carrie.
How do you spell that?
C-A-R-R-I-E. She would love it.
Weighing 287 pounds, Mankind!
He was born Mick Foley on Long Island, New York. His manifestations as Dude Love and Cactus Jack are infamous, but none are more deranged than Mankind.
It was 1996 when Mick Foley belted a Hannibal Lecter mask over his face and stepped into the ring as Mankind, one of the darkest, most unhinged, most controversial, and most successful characters in professional wrestling history. The same year Mankind was born, 1996, Mick Foley visited Santa's Village in Jefferson, New Hampshire.
I was probably 16 or 17 when Mick first came to the park.
Christian Gaynor runs Santa's Village with his sister and brother-in-law. A third-generation owner, Gaynor's grandparents opened the park in 1953, and he grew up here.
You know, he was a WWE superstar. He was the guy on TV. I didn't approach him at all. I was like half a dozen other employees, and we're just kind of following around, seeing what he did. And from place to place, all of our employees would get excited and ask him questions about wrestling and wrestling Hulk Hogan and all the other big names of the WWE. But as his day kept on going, he kept on getting more inspired by the park and by the enthusiasm of our employees. And it just created a buzz for everybody. And there's been no turning back since.
I think I was able to explore that darker side. Because I had the yearly visits to this place. I honestly feel like that helped me cope, that I could really be convincing in my bad guy mannerisms, because I had a really nice counterbalance in the, you know, in the joy of Christmas.
Every year he's here unannounced, he shows up, he's part of the family. We welcome him with open arms and his whole family.
As a matter of fact, it was on that roller coaster there, climbing the peak, that my daughter, who in 1998 would have been 4, kissed me on the cheek. And when I asked her what that kiss was for, she said, "Because you're a good man." And slightly more than 24 hours later, I was thrown off a massive steel structure by The Undertaker. And so after all these years, one of the great questions I have is, what in the world was I doing at Santa's Village the day before the biggest match in my career?
Not only the biggest match in his career, Hell in a Cell is considered one of the great events in WWE history, and saw Mankind being thrown not once, but twice from a height of 16 feet. The first fall was highly planned and well practiced, but the second, which knocked him unconscious, was an accident. The injuries he sustained during Hell in a Cell hastened the end of his formal wrestling career in 2000.
But yeah, I just remember that. You know, going up there, kissing me on the cheek, telling me I was a good man.
Does that create any kind of, like, conflict for you when you think about those two things together?
I don't. Not a conflict. I mean, it's a great paradox. Yeah. But I learned to live with it.
In 1999, during an autograph session, Foley got the sense that his days as Mankind were coming to an end, and that another character, maybe his last, was preparing to emerge.
And off in the distance, about, you know, halfway through this massive line, I saw this little boy with the telltale scars of many, many surgeries for severe burns.
Foley called the boy up to the front of the line.
But it was then that his mother told me that Antonio had needed to wear a mask during the process of his healing. At the time, he was three, and like most three-year-olds, wanted nothing to do with the wearing of a mask, until his mother told him that his favorite wrestler, Mankind, wore a mask. And it kind of filled me with this sense of joy. It was almost like I could feel my conscience calling out to me. And so I asked his mom if he could sit on my lap while I took care of the rest of the people in line. And people were visibly moved. Like, there were people wiping away tears. And as he walked away, I got this distinct feeling that I knew what it was like to be Santa Claus. And a distinct feeling that this was something I would like to experience again.
And so he did. After visiting Sierra Leone in 2008... Foley funded construction of a large primary school there, which was completed in 2009. In 2011 alone, as a volunteer for the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, Foley logged more than 550 hours talking to victims. Following Hurricane Sandy, Foley gave his dining room furniture to a Long Island family who'd lost theirs in the storm. He then promptly invited himself over for dinner, so he could eat at his old table one last time. In 2012, it became official.
I have an official ambassador's letter that proclaims me an official ambassador, so that anytime I put on the red suit, I am officially known as Santa Mick.
Foley was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2013. He knew exactly how he wanted to go out. Exactly how he wanted to leave his fans.
I tried to talk Mr. McMahon into allowing me to exit Madison Square Garden on a sleigh flying into the sky. And I knew he had the capability of making it happen. He just didn't understand why it was so important to me.
And so, below a half moon, on a snowbound night, high on a hill in the town of Littleton, an unexpectedly large man with an overturned bucket of tangled hair, stepped into the lobby of the Hampton Inn.
And you, young man, what would you like for Christmas?
Maroon catching gear.
Maroon catching gear. I can do that.
None of the children and none of their parents knew who the man in the red suit was. They called him Santa, and they knew inside him lay all the goodness and all the care and all the mystery and hope. Inside him, the single, simple majesty we believe exists in the very heart of all of mankind. For Word of Mouth, and yes, Virginia, there is a Mick Foley. This is Sean Hurley.
If you'd like to see Mick Foley in action, he's the subject of a new documentary streaming now on Netflix. It's called I Am Santa Claus. There's a link to watch the film, as well as some photos of Mick at Santa's Village on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Next month, the 2015 Paralympic Nordic Skiing World Championships will be held in Cable, Wisconsin. Athletes from more than 25 countries will call upon years of training and some incredible custom-built equipment in hopes of achieving glory. From skiing to soccer, technology has helped athletes with disabilities compete at the very highest levels. But the perks of advancing prosthetics are not limited to sports. Gil Weinberg is founding director of the Georgia Tech Center for Music Technology. Earlier this year, he developed a robotic prosthesis for the drummer Jason Barnes, who lost an arm in an accident. We spoke with him about it in March. So Jason had built his own prosthetic shortly after his accident, but it was pretty limited. What is it that makes drumming such a difficult activity to duplicate with an ordinary prosthetic?
So Jason is very creative, and he did use some springs and other equipment to build an arm that he can hit with because he still has an elbow, so he can move his arm. But drummers use their wrists and their fingers in a very expressive way. That's how you control the color of the sound. That's how you control how the stick bounces on the drum. And he couldn't control that. So when he saw some of my old robots online, I developed robotic musicians that actually play with humans. He asked me, can you please develop myoelectric, which is connected to the muscles, and you can get information from other muscles that you still have, and myoelectric arm that will allow me to control the operation of a wrist of a finger, which I don't have.
So the new prosthetic, robotic prosthetic that you designed looks a little like something that RoboCop might use if he were in a band. Can you describe it for us? And did it pick up those movements that Jason was looking for?
Sure. So currently it's pretty exposed. We are working on a shell for it so it would look slicker and nicer. The arm has two sticks. One of the sticks is connected to his forearm muscles, which we still have just below the elbow. Mm-hmm. And it can flex and relax this muscle to actually operate the arm and operate how tight the stick is being held. So if the stick is being held tightly, you have a certain kind of sound and a certain kind of bounce on the drum, and you can play drum rolls in different speed and so on. So that's basically what he wanted. But my research is also about creating new interactions between humans and robots. So I suggested to him to add another stick that will not be connected directly to his muscles or to any part of his body, but will actually have what I call a mind of its own. And by that I mean that there's a small computer chip on this stick, and it listens to the music that Jason is doing or playing. It listens to the music that other musicians are playing, and based on that, it enhances and plays back at Jason to create something interesting. And when Jason listens to his own arm building on what he plays and kind of playing off him, he hopefully will be inspired to push his music to new directions. And that's what interests me in the research. So together we're able to have an arm that addresses his needs and also makes a nice platform for me to explore new ways to create human-robot collaborations, where the connection between the human and the robot is very intimate. It's actually part of your body.
Well, let's listen to just a clip of Jason practicing with the new prosthetic. And he's actually experimenting with it. It gives us a little bit of a sense of the evolution. Let's hear that. Gil Weinberg, tell us what we're listening to here. What did we just hear?
So the first thing we heard is how Jason, with his muscles, operates one of the sticks and creates some hits on the cymbal. Then we heard on the snare drum him actually pushing the limit of the speed that we have embedded in the arm and actually able to play much faster than any human. We have 15 hertz, meaning 15 times a second. Each stick can hit as fast as 15 times a second. So together it's almost 30 hertz, 30 times a second, which is much faster than human can. And even though that wasn't what we were aiming for, we actually created some superhuman capabilities with this arm that he likes to explore. And you hear him going back and forth on the skin off the snare and exploring different timbres with really, really fast drumming.
He's doing this with one arm and this other stick, this robotic prosthetic that you created, rather than two hands. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. One arm control two sticks, and together one arm can play up to 30 times a second.
Mm.
And then you had some of the other instruments joining, and then we did some trading fours, which is a jazz kind of term, meaning the drummer is listening to some solo and improvisation from one musician, and then he answers with his own solo. And in this case, what we can do is take some of the improvisation from the musicians and actually embed it in the arm itself. So suddenly you hear the trumpet player, we analyze what the trumpet player is playing and put it in the arm, and you hear the trumpet playing through your arm, which is, again, a new experience, maybe a new intimate connection between you and your fellow players, which hopefully will push music to new directions and create new interactions that would be interesting.
Oh, it was just fascinating to listen to and hearing you explain it even more so. But I'm wondering about Jason's particular condition. I mean, every disability is unique. And the prosthetic in this case was specifically fitted to this individual, what kind of things he was looking at, the kind of addition that you wanted to make and the work that you've done. Now, that sounds to me like it'd be quite a challenge, quite an opportunity, and quite expensive. How much did it cost to make this prosthetic?
So we received funding from the National Science Foundation for this research. And the funding is to fund students and to fund research and equipment and so on. So we cannot direct it to how much will a production version of this arm will cost. The grant that we received was close to $150,000, and we still have almost a half of it. So just the research phase is not maybe as expensive as some people may expect. If and when it becomes commercial, which I don't have any plans at this point, it probably can be much cheaper, because a lot of the money went to the research, to explore different directions that work, some directions that didn't work, and so on.
Gil Weinberg, I'm very interested in what you called another stick, a robotic prosthetic with a mind of its own, you know, which introduces a whole lot of things that either make people scared or quite full of wonder. Tell me about how this prosthetic works with a mind of its own.
So the mind of its own is mostly related to the second stick. Even in some cases, we put a mind of its own for the original stick as well. And what it does, it listens to the other musicians, it detects music, it tries to understand music like humans understand it, understand the rhythms, understand the chord progression, if there's some chords in it, understand what the tempo, how loud it's being played. So everything that is Jason controlling, and sometimes other musicians are playing, is being sensed and analyzed by this computer that operates the stick and brings it to some kind of a musical state of mind. So we're trying to develop artificial intelligence for music. And then based on that, it improvises. So if it hears there's a rhythm that is sparse, maybe, it can decide for itself, I will fill it up. I will have some triplets and 16ths and 30 seconds note here because something is missing. If it listens to a particular pattern from a different musician that it thinks, that was an interesting rhythmic pattern, I want to repeat it, it will try to repeat it, maybe ornament it and change it a little bit to see how Jason reacts to it.
Gil Weinberg is founding director of the Georgia Tech Center for Music Technology, and he's responsible for a number of absolutely incredible projects that bridge the gap between robotics and music. You can see plenty of them, including an incredible video of drummer Jason Barnes playing with the prosthetic drum arm. The links are all at wordofmouthradio.org.